Why you wanna fly, blackbird? You ain't ever gonna fly. Why you wanna fly? Place big enough for holding all the tears you're gonna cry. Cause your mama's name was Lonely and your daddy's name was Pain. They call you Little Sorrow, 'cause you'll never love again. So why you wanna fly?
Welcome to the Ferguson Response Network podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack, and you're joining us for episode 13 of the Ferguson Response Network podcast, a weekly podcast devoted to supporting citizens working to create lasting social change through sustained civil disobedience and civic action. I'm joined, as always, by my amazing co-host, Ricky L. Hines II. What's going on, Ricky?
What's up? I'm in a relatively good mood considering today.
I know. You must not have had bad traffic today, I was figuring.
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much. If you don't know him, Ricky is a Los Angeles native, a U.S. Navy veteran, avid Googler, blogger, founder of the Americans United Again movement, and he hosts two other podcasts, the Americans United Again podcast, and with the lovely Sherelle, he co-hosts the AUA Hope podcast.
And to add, I'm acting co-host of the Peniman Doctrine.
Doctrine.
Molly comes back.
That's right, standing in for the president herself. She's on her leave. Very good. If you have not listened to the show before, you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Ferguson Response Network, or you can find us on our website, FergusonResponse.org. If you have actions coming up in your area, or if you're looking to find an action in your area supporting the Black Lives Matter movement, go to FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. And we are lucky enough to have a special guest this evening, one Zelly Imani. What's going on, Zelly?
What's going on? How you doing?
Doing good. Great to hear your voice. I know we're always tweeting each other all the time, so it's always good when we get to speak in more than 140 characters. Yay!
That's always great.
Always wonderful. If you don't know him, Zelly is a writer, photographer, activist, and teacher based in North Jersey. He's also the creator and voice behind Black Culture, a blog created to explore and expose Black history and Black culture through a series of stories, photos, and short films. I actually also want to read the mission from Black Culture, which I absolutely love. Black Culture is driven to produce positive images of Black people in order to negate the negative influences that popular media produces. It is an attempt to break away from stereotypes to show the diversity of Blackness. It is an attempt to destroy the old Eurocentric and patriarchal standards of beauty to show the vibrancy and beauty of Blackness. I love that mission.
Can I point out, this right here just shows exactly, it negates the thought that Black people are lazy. Everybody on this podcast is like seven different jobs.
Right?
The truth. The absolute truth. So I guess we'll go through some news to start off with. We'll take at the top the beating of the University of Virginia student Martise Johnson. I hope I said his name correctly. Ricky, do you have the video? I know there was some video taken on scene during the altercation, which happened outside of a bar in Charlottesville, Virginia. And the ostensive start of the interaction was due to a fake ID that Martise had and was denied entry to a bar in the early morning hours of St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, and here's the video now, or at least the audio from it.
Thanks.
Wait, give me your phone.
I go to UVA, you fucking racist. What the fuck? How did this happen, you racist?
They were just like, yo, what is
this? How did this happen, you fucking racist?
Yo, was that necessary, yo?
Oh my gosh.
Mm. Yeah. I don't even know what to say. Like, it's for those who don't live in Virginia, Virginia has basically control. The government has control of their alcohol distribution. So they don't have like liquor stores. They just have ABC stores, which sell liquor. And the only other places you can get them are, you know, of course, at bars and other shit like that. But you can also get liquor on military installations. That's it. So this the police or the officers themselves, like, there's no reason for this shit. It really isn't. You're there enforcing someone trying to drink underage. It's not like he was drunk already, because he wouldn't fucking be there.
There's so many things about the video that are disturbing to me. I'm still formulating my thoughts. Zelly, what are you hearing? What have you heard? I know it's been, there was a strong response from UVA students last night, and I did see a statement from their president also. And the governor has asked for an independent investigation to be done, because it did involve the, liquor control, police, but what are your thoughts?
Also the same thing. I'm scattered around a lot of this. I'm in contact with a lot of students that are attending that particular university. I should be calling them later on tonight to get an update, because they had a private meeting tonight for just black students. So that started around like 7 p.m. So I'm giving them some time, and then I'm going to hit them up to see what they discussed and what's their next plans and actions. Today they had a hashtag UVA demands, really putting out their demands for the school and the demands for the ABC, like you had mentioned earlier, and as well as the community and overall.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. A few things, and this is something I have said on this show many times, which is that, you know, there's lots of things that are bad about respectability politics. But for me, the worst part of respectability politics is that they're fucking dangerous. Because you hear in Martisa's voice when he says, I'm a UVA student, that, you know, on some subconscious level, he thought that was a layer of protection that he had from this state sanctioned violence. And it's just not true. And it's heartbreaking to me to see this. And I was talking to my husband last night as all of this news was coming out, and everything that I see, you know, police. I don't even know. I was talking the other day about how the hardest thing for white people to grasp, or what will be, I think, the hardest thing, especially for white men to grasp, is that they really are not very special. You know, they have been sold their whole life this bill of goods that they achieve because they're exceptional. And in reality, they achieve because they're set up to achieve. And so it's going to be a rude awakening to realize that all of these wonderful things you thought about yourself are in fact really not that impressive. I'm not impressed that you are CEO of some company when your dad was one. Like, it's just not impressive to me, and it's not impressive. It shouldn't be impressive to anybody. And I think that is becoming more and more clear. And so that's an extreme on one end of a very successful person that is going to have this realization. I feel like police are the first line of that realization, because they're a little lower on the spectrum of success, and their badges have made them think that they are special. And the entire Black Lives Matter movement and the groundswell that it has picked up, and the unapologetic way that Black people are saying, yeah, no, you're not exceptional and you're not special just because you have that badge on. They just seem to be ratcheting things up. And I see these interactions with quote unquote respectable, educated, well-dressed Black people as these shows of force in these areas. And of course, we'll be supporting anything that comes out of UVA and whatever the students decide to do there on the Tumblr and online and everything else like that. But, Ricky, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, your respectability will not save you. That, you know, really doesn't matter. The second someone in a position of power sees you as a threat because of your skin color, they don't say shit. Doesn't matter what you've done. Doesn't matter. And we talked about this. And the professor's son was pulled over leaving the library, or stopped when he was leaving the library. Like, it's not. We keep telling y'all. We keep telling you respectable Black people. This shit happens anyway. You know, it's. You're not exempt. You're really not.
Right, and the reason why I say it's dangerous is because, you know, we need to be aware of our surroundings and the possibilities that exist there. And if you have this idea that your upbringing or your clothing or your resume is going to stop you from being treated badly, you don't have that awareness about you. And it's dangerous because we can't stop somebody from being racist towards us, but it's very important that we're aware of what's going on around us, because nobody else is aware for us. And so that's why I say respectability politics are just flat out dangerous, besides just being wrong and useless, pretty much, for the most part.
Right. It's dangerous for, like, multiple different levels, too, right? Because it's a shame that we have to highlight the fact that Martise was an honor student to get empathy for his victimhood. Because as if, you know, oh, he didn't rob a liquor store, or he wasn't, you know, doing some criminal act, or he didn't have no criminal history, so we should value his life, you know, like his life matters, like his Black life matters. And it kind of distracts from our whole philosophy that Black lives matters, that all Black lives matter, whether you're incarcerated or not, whether you're an honor student or not a student at all. Like, Black lives matter.
Absolutely.
Zoe, I agree, but the other thing is that it depends on the audience, because a lot of times when we're saying these types of things and we're pointing these things out, it's not the people who already understand that, but it's the people who are living in denial anyway. You got to kind of dig them out of one phase of denial before you get them to the next.
But what I found is that the people who have internalized this anti-Blackness, they're going to deny it regardless. You know, they're going to find any excuse to fault him for his behavior. So, for example, I had mentioned the fact that a lot of them are blaming him for his drunkenness, right? Are probably the same people who excuse SAE for their actions based on their drunkenness. Right. You know, like, oh, they was just drunk. Excuse them.
Was he even drunk? Behaviors.
That's another thing. That's another thing. Don't know.
It wasn't. That would have been something that would have come out, that his blood alcohol level. As a nigga with a DUI, I know.
Yeah, especially because he did have to go to the hospital to get stitches. So,
but remember the original report that ABC had put out was saying that he was intoxicated, or it was belligerent and all those other type of things.
Yeah,
you don't know if that's like a fact if they did, you know, blood alcohol test, but they had initially said that.
You can even hear on the tape or see on the video where he says, the one cop says, stop resisting. And he's not resisting. He's just telling you you're a fucking racist.
Right.
Him talking is not resisting. He wasn't moving.
Yeah.
He wasn't trying to fight back. He didn't move any part of his body. He literally was just talking to you. And now that's resisting?
In a nonviolent manner.
When I see
it's such a bullshit
video after video of white people telling cops off, going after them, calling them everything
kicking
but a
them
child
in the,
of
in the
God,
genitals.
All sorts of stuff. This guy that just had that went on the shooting spree that they managed to take down with a taser somehow, shot all kinds of people.
He's alive, though.
He sure is.
And Mike Brown, who was accused of stealing cigars and didn't steal cigars, but was being a bit of a dick, admittedly. He was 18. 18-year-olds are dicks. He's dead.
Right.
Yep. Yep. It's interesting that you mentioned that the students at UVA were having a separate meeting of just black students. Over last week on Ferguson Response, we had my friend TMR, who is an educator at Oak Park River Forest High School in Chicago, Illinois, talk about a Black Lives Matter assembly that her principal held for just black students to talk about it's kind of the culmination at the end of Black History Month. And these white parents went berserker because their children were not allowed, calling for this principal's resignation and threatening lawsuits because they feel that this violated equal opportunity rules that they have in place in the school district.
Yeah, that's such a bullshit assertion. They've called it unconstitutional and all this other BS, but the only way that you could point that this was unconstitutional would be is if you were using Plessy versus Ferguson. Or, I'm sorry, Brown versus BOE.
Which is what they're calling, by the way. School board president John Phelan, a lawyer by trade, said he was concerned about a process that led to an event that could be considered separate but equal, a segregationist doctrine that was later deemed unconstitutional with the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education case.
Yeah, but what they ignore is the fact that the ruling stated that at a large systemic level, separate but equal was effectively impossible. In this school, it's possible. You have it when you have a basketball team, or you have it when you have football players that have an assembly. You have it when you have the fucking people in the Spanish club. You know, it doesn't hold water when you look at the rationale. This is what I talk about when I'm always saying people are telling the truth, but they're only telling the half truth.
Right.
Like, yeah, it kind of goes in violation of Plessy versus Ferguson if you ignore the context for that ruling.
Right. Obviously, the principal had the support and awareness of the superintendent, Stephen Ayosi, who said he believed he was the only non-black person at the assembly. I believe he's Latino. And he says, it was clear to me that Mr. Rouse was trying to build a space that was safe, that was a safe space for our black students. It's just
who were planning to walk out anyway.
They were literally planning a protest to walk out, and the principal said, "Hey, instead of walking out, why don't we all come together and have a couple hours?" They had a panel of both black students and black educators and administrators to talk about what it's like living in their world as black people and kind of having this great conversation. And you know, the most heartbreaking thing to me was I spoke to Tia after the assembly, and she was like, oh, Leslie, it was so awesome seeing, you know, 400 to 500 black students all together talking with each other about these important things and coming together. And she was feeling so good about it, and the students were feeling so good about it. And then to hear these people trying to turn it into something so ugly that it's like taken all of the wind out of these students' sails. And, you know, I just...
Right. I think in that article in the Chicago Tribune, they have said citizens who spoke at the meeting said they believe this is an issue only because it involves black children, and that if the assembly were female or gay only, no one would complain. Right. That people would accept that if it was a gay space, it was a female space, like it would be accepted.
Right.
And this kind of comes back to me about this whole anti-blackness that's kind of embedded in, you know, American society, that black people can't have that space and black people just can't have anything to themselves, really, because it kind of, for me, brings back images and the realities of slave laws, right? Yeah. And that how blacks could not assemble, or slaves could not assemble in more than groups of three or four, you know, or slaves could not assemble more than 12 for a funeral for some places, or slaves couldn't even gather for a church. It's like this fear of black people mass assembling to talk about the things that they need to talk about or strategize, you know, even NAACP meetings back in the 30s and 40s were firebombed constantly, you know, or things in the 60s with the civil rights movements, these mass meetings of African-Americans were always targeted, you know, like we cannot ever have a safe space for ourselves, whether legally or not.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to it making people uncomfortable, it making white people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Hence why, like, when I worked at a call center, I worked in a call center in the South for a cable company. It was a small cable company. There are two things that I had a problem with that I would, like, other than, like, the customer being outright fucking racist, that I checked them on. One, when they complain about having to press one for English. Two, when they said that this is an English that the national language of this country is English. Neither of true. And so I would snap, like, what do you mean? It's the people are doing something that I can't understand, I can't keep an eye on, so I don't trust it. Meanwhile, I have my own space in which to do so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And can ignore everything else as well.
Exactly.
Zelly, as you mentioned, the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act, I actually have an infographic that we created to kind of tie the Fugitive Slave Act and what they included in that to law enforcement tactics today. So the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which was used by slave patrols, monitored the rigid pass requirements for blacks traversing the countryside. Totally sounds like person of color searches on our national roadways. And we saw that in the Ferguson DOJ report quite clearly, and also in New York as well. And Texas has been several. Boston had the same results. They were also asked to break up large gatherings and assemblies, as you mentioned. They were able to visit and search slave quarters randomly. Sounds like search and frisk to me. They were able to inflict impromptu punishments, extrajudicial killings. Mm-hmm. And as occasion arose, they were encouraged to suppress insurrections.
Mm. This also sounds like jail. Sounds like jail, and it sounds like how we're policed in our own communities. Oops. No one thinks that that's a problem. Can be honest. There is a certain population of the black community, particularly black males, who don't really give a fuck about going to prison because they're policed just as heavily out like in the streets as they are there. Fuck, do they care? And plus, they don't have opportunities for work. You know, you take these basically getting a felony in this country ruins your life, especially when you're black. It rings true throughout all of the policies that we think about and we have problems with. They all root back to one specific cause:
white supremacy.
Thank you.
White supremacy. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, when we were talking about the DOJ report, 75% of a black population in a city have arrest warrants. I mean, this is just insanity. And mm-hmm. I don't know if it's that common where you live. That means that you don't really have to do anything. You live exactly. in that neighborhood and you're black, you have an arrest warrant, regardless of circumstance, pretty much.
Mind you, crime is lower than the national average in Ferguson. Just thought I'd point that out. So, if they're lower than the national average, what should it be for a white community that's also lower than the national average? Shouldn't it be at about 75%? Mm. And would they be okay with that? Fuck no. There'd be a revolution.
Speaking of Department of Justice, news coming from the Justice Department, civil rights lawyers are planning to travel to Ferguson in the coming weeks to meet with residents and help decide whether to reform the police department or disband it and replace it with a regional force. That's according to the head of the Department Civil Rights Division, and acting Assistant Attorney General Vanita Gupta said that her lawyers want to ensure that the systemic racial bias and constitutional violations identified in the scathing justice report don't continue for a day longer than they should. What kind of police department do Ferguson residents want? All of the options are on the table, and now we're going to roll up our sleeves and figure out what does this look like. Some of what has happened in the last week really demonstrates the urgency of putting together an agreement. What are your thoughts on this, Ellie? I mean, What could come out of this, really? I don't hear them talking about supremacy in the context of that Department of Justice report. So to me, until we start naming it as such, I don't know what they're talking about. Changing policy, changing procedure, but again, not getting to this root cause.
Yeah, it's trimming the tree again, and I mean, in some respects, that's
all
job.
They can do. That's all they can do,
yeah. Right?
At this point, yeah. Because they can't name it. They can't name it as white supremacy, and they really can't name it as state violence because they are
part of the state.
They're part of the state, you know. So it's very difficult for them to name it. Particularly, the other problematic aspect of this is that you can't really disband Ferguson Police Department. What does that actually mean? Does that mean that those police officers are going to be, dissolved into other police departments? You know, so is that problem actually going to be solved, or are you just spreading that problem out to other areas now? Mm-hmm. And then the other problematic part is that when you look back at the uprising in Ferguson, right? It wasn't just Ferguson Police Department that was shooting tear gas at everyone. It was, the county and all these other police departments.
City, National Guard, all of the above.
All of the above. Yeah. So what are you really saying? You know, like, this is not going to end state violence in Ferguson just by, dissolving the police department there. No, it's not going to solve anything, really.
I think it's a direction that we can go in. I mean, there are honestly so many ways that we could go with this, and there are things that have to be considered depending on which way you're going. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're going to keep the Ferguson Police Department, or if you're not going to disband them, then you have to look at, okay, well, how do we stop this type of behavior within this police department? Because the reality is, and I think I said this last show, they still need jobs. So they're still going to be pulling people over just as often as they are now because the taxes aren't there. The revenue isn't there to support them. And so, okay, cool. If we're going to keep this department, we want them to lighten up on the citizens. Okay, where does this money then come from to pay for the shit that they're doing to people?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously they don't need as big a police force as they have. So that's the first thing.
No.
But secondly, the thing I think that I'm interested in seeing is, much like almost everything else that's happened in Ferguson, the citizens there have proven to be adept at working on a problem in a unique way. And so I can't wait to hear what the local residents and the protesters there have to say about what their thoughts are for what this should look like. And I expect to see lots of focused and pointed decisions put forth from them, especially, as Zelly said, about making sure that these officers are not just allowed to go back and work somewhere else. Because lest we forget, Darren Wilson came from a disbanded police department that was completely disbanded for racial bias as well. So he was quote unquote only there for 5 months. But the fact remains that it was disbanded and he was hired by Ferguson police. So
the cop who killed Tamir Rice.
Same thing.
Told that, same thing. He was fired from another police agency, told that he didn't need to be in a capacity where he carried a gun. And then, he is, and a black kid gets killed.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested, regardless of the eventual outcome, and I do think obviously some things are going to change there. They don't have no choice but to at this point. But I am interested to see how the process goes. I think this is a very unique situation, much like everything else that's happened in Ferguson. We haven't seen it before. We haven't seen a Justice Department report come out against an entire police force and entire black and on the side of an entire black community like this. And it's very public. And so I'm interested to see what this process looks like, because I don't think we've seen anything like it before. It'll be interesting to see and what happens, because obviously, as everything else has, it'll have repercussions moving forward from there. So discuss race or discussing race or race, whatever this insanity from Starbucks is. Race together. Thank you. I'm so irritated by it. I just deleted it immediately from my memory banks because I'm so fully agitated by this idea. One thing that I saw that really caught my eye about why this is problematic: if you look at the statistics of Starbucks, 78-80% of their customers are white. Almost half of their employees are of color. So your plan is to have your majority white clientele come in and most likely, or at least half the time, come in contact with a person of color that they now have to talk. You're forcing people of color to teach white people about race. Just statistically speaking. You're also... even in that interaction, you have a white person that's completely in a power position as the customer and a person of color who is by nature of the transaction in a lowered position. How are they going
to
have a
conversation? And less likely to be honest, to be able to be honest, to be honest.
Zelly, what are your thoughts? I mean, I don't even know what to say about this.
That is just mind-blowing. I thought it was a joke at first.
It sounds like an SNL skit, to be perfectly honest.
It really did. Like, I ignored the hashtag for like the whole day because I thought it was a bad The Onion joke, you know? Like a bad satire. I had no clue that it was something that was real.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's tough because, you know, like you said, like if half the employees were black, and Starbucks for years now had these, you know, labor disputes, you know, because there was like, I'm not even sure if they're still not unionized, but that was a big issue that the baristas did not have their own union. And, you know, then it's just a whole issue with, you know, the coffee beans coming from West Africa and those people being exploited for the beans. So it's like, what are you really talking about in your whole race conversation? And the other aspect of that is I really hate that word race conversation because having a conversation implies that there's someone listening. And it's always the case that black people are talking and white people are just not listening. That's not a conversation at all. That's just white that's just black people talking.
No, but the what they consider a conversation isn't that dynamic at all. That's exactly what is expected in that Starbucks campaign. White people telling black people about racism. Think about it. Every time you just had Waka Flocka Flame on, or they were talking about Waka Flocka Flame in hip hop with four fucking white people. Really? Come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
That's true.
And none of them raps. Like, had it been four white people and one of them was like Eminem, I'd be upset, but I'd be like 10% less upset.
But it's just like this, how they keep debating the N word on CNN. Like, for what purpose?
You don't get to make that decision
and over again. Like, why are you even talking about this? Stop saying it and shut the fuck up about it. It's enough already.
And then we had, you know, W.E. Du Bois write about the Negro problem in the early 1900s. Why are we still having this conversation? Like, we've been having this conversation for like centuries now. Like, okay, we had this conversation, where are we going to move forward?
Yeah. Your move, white people. How about that?
Your move. We know the issue is
white people. We got it. Okay.
It's y'all, white supremacy.
Yeah, because I'm actually, my younger brother posted something about it yesterday. And I guess somebody had said something about the N-word and whether or not it could be said. And I had like this had this long diatribe as to whether or not, like, when it would be acceptable. I'm trying to find it here.
Mark Lamont Hill talking to Trinidad was the best, though. I was just cracking up.
Oh, my God.
He's like, I will call him my nigga, because he is my nigga. I was like, oh, boy. It's getting hot. Don Lemon didn't know what to say. He was like, what? Yeah. Did you find it, Ricky?
I'm still looking.
You still looking?
Oh, there it is. There it is. I know that.
Hit us with it.
Nope, that's wrong one still. Damn it, man.
Well,
my brother posts a lot.
The other thing I wanted to mention, just finishing up the news, is that apparently the police killed twice as many people as reported by the U.S. government. They omitted 554 people per year in the study.
Wow.
This is from the trusted FBI count of, quote, justifiable homicides in the United States. This was the first time they've attempted to actually keep a record of the number of uncounted law enforcement homicides. Previous official tallies is capturing less than half of the real picture. So the new estimate, 924 people killed by police annually over 8 years, compared to the 383 in the published FBI data.
Wow.
So there's that.
Wow. That's just mind blowing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I mean, we know it happens, but fuck, really?
Yeah.
That often.
Yeah.
It's draining too, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really draining. Even hearing the audio or watching the video of Martise, or just seeing a lot of this imagery and this audio of state violence against black people, it's really draining and traumatizing.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredibly draining, and I don't think white people even have a iota of a clue. I mean, I know they're never.
Oh, they have a clue.
They have a clue.
To think
they're always warning of it. Think about it. They're always warning of, the government coming to take your guns and shit. What they neglect to say is that they're perfectly okay when that happens to black people. So they, until it comes to us, they don't give a damn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. The numbers are just staggering, though. A recent report estimated that there were 7,427 law enforcement homicides in the U.S. during the 8 years spanning 03 to 09.
Yikes.
That average of 928 per year.
One of the other things for me, though, is that I've noticed ever since Ferguson and being involved in a lot of these protests and a lot of these actions, my relationship with the police has changed a lot. Mm. I'm kind of less fearful of them because I guess seeing all this death, I'm kind of expecting it now.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yo, you're going to do whatever you're going to do. So it's like, whatever. Because I got pulled over this weekend by the police. Like, as soon as I exited the parking lot, I pulled up next to a cop car. He looked at me, and then when I started to inch up a little bit, he started running my plates and then pulled me over, you know? So, you know, it's that profiling. And even when he came up to me at the window, there was like a 5 second pause, because I guess he expected me to say like, yes, officer, what is it? But I'm like looking at him like what? Like, what do you want? Like, you tell me why you pulled me over. Like, I'm not going to be begging, you know, and, you know, calling to you. Tell me why you pull me over.
It's really mm-hmm. true. You know, when I see those not your respectable Negro t-shirts, I have one too. It puts me in mind of that. I was talking to somebody the other day about it, and it was like, you know, the thing about Black Lives Matter is that when you really internalize the message that is contained within that phrase,
mm-hmm.
the way that you interact with the world changes, because the realization that there's nothing wrong with blackness, there's nothing wrong with black people, there's nothing wrong with the black community, that the complete annihilation of white supremacy won't cure. So mm-hmm. when you realize that fact, it changes your reaction to everything and your relationship with everything, because you know there's nothing you can do. to right. affect what that cop is going to do, or what the racist at the grocery store is going to do, or what any white person is going to do, because they're going to do what they're going to do. And so it's there's a freeing part of it. But mm-hmm. with that freedom comes, as Zelly mentioned, the absorption as well of all that that entails and all that yeah. that means, which is, you know, there is a level of helplessness in it because we can't really affect what other people can do. But mm-hmm. we also yeah, aren't.
I finally found the paragraph that I wrote, but sorry, go ahead.
And the other thing, too, is that it's kind of a sense of empowerment a little bit, I guess, because that we have this power now from social media. Like, we really tapped into that. And then even from everything that's been going on in the summer, we've began this culture of protest and this culture of, you know, always amplifying the stories and putting things out there that I know that if something happens to me, whether, you know, I'm a victim, whether I survive or not, like, I'm able to put my story out there and it's not going to be swept under the rug no more. Like, these things would not be silenced no more. I would not be erased no more. That there's people out there willing to listen and put my story out there. So it's that sense of empowerment where it's like, what are you going to do, officer? Because, you know, we can take it to the next level. Like, I'm good.
Absolutely.
Well, it's definitely empowering. But the other thing, too, is it brings some people a lot of anxiety. Why should I have to be policing the people that I pay to enforce the law?
Right.
To enforce it fairly. Yeah. Like, to be honest, like, I can't smoke. I don't smoke in my apartment. So when I step outside, I'm usually like, I don't, on the sidewalk, just having a cigarette. Uh-huh. If I don't have my phone on me, I'm fucking nervous as shit. It is what it is, because I don't know what could happen. Especially if it's, you know, 10, 11 o'clock at night.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm outside in basketball shorts and a t-shirt, just chilling, not minding my own business. But I know that me minding my own business and not being aware of my surroundings have me dead, and it's not from civilians, it's from the people I pay to protect me.
That outfit sounds very intimidating. I just want you to know.
I know. Well, I mean, being naked is intimidating, apparently. So, whatever clothes you have on, that's just that's icing on the cake
for sure. Screwdrivers against bulletproof vests, all of those things. It's a frightening world out there. Well, let's move to the heart of the show, and I wanted to talk about a bunch of stuff with Zelly since, you know, his site and blog focus so much on reclaiming the narrative for Black people. The first subject I wanted to kind of tackle a little bit was just arts and social justice and where we get to see that flourishing since the Black Lives Matter movement has started picking up steam, and certainly since the events in Ferguson. So, Zelly, talk to me a little bit. I know you guys have stuff on your site all the time surrounding the arts and Blackness in the arts. Where do you see that fitting into the Black Lives Matter movement?
In what sense?
Just generally speaking, do you see artists reacting to the Black Lives Matter movement, and where do you see it kind of showing itself within the arts and in the Black community?
Okay, yeah, definitely. Let me think some. Because I think a lot of times when we talk about artists, like our main instant reactions think about, you know, mainstream artists or hip-hop artists or R&B artists, right? And how are they engaging in this talk about Black Lives Matters. And we kind of always forget that, you know, there's photographers out there, there's painters out there, and all these other type of conceptual artists who are really doing, like, phenomenal work, but they're not as praised or uplifted or amplified as, you know, mainstream artists. But they're still doing, like, some really phenomenal work in regards to Blackness and diversity, and really talking about these issues and, you know, engaging in critical ways.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think visual arts are really important. And the thing that I've been really kind of focused on for me in terms of the arts is the erasure of Black art in our country, generally speaking. And so I like to look at the history. You know, we have had amazing Black artists forever. The fact that they're never recognized for their greatness is where we need to focus our energy. I actually went on a tour this morning, actually the first half of the day, in at the Philadelphia Art Museum was one part of it. They have an amazing new exhibit there called Represent, 200 Years of African American Art. It only runs for a couple more weeks, but it highlights selections from the museum's exceptional holdings of African American art and celebrates the publication of a catalog examining the breadth of these noteworthy collections. And they have works by Henry Owasa Tanner, Horace Pippin, Jacob Lawrence, and Carrie Mae Weems. And the exhibition was amazing. The curator actually took us through the exhibition itself, and it really highlights the complexities of African-American art and artists, whether they be classically trained, which there are numerous ones over the last 200 years, classically trained and then sat at the feet of the masters in Paris to continue their education afterwards, after they got their formal education in the Philadelphia area and beyond. And non-classically trained artists who just had their talent on display because they were bursting with artistic pride and skill. So I love to see stuff like that, because it really is important for all of us to look not just forward but also backward, because this erasure has been going on for a long time. And reclaiming that narrative is also going back and saying, yeah, everything that we've ever been taught ever, just like, it wasn't true. So, or even if part of it was true, it's not the whole story. So we need to go back and really look at all, when we talk about impressionism, there are black impressionists. When we talk about portraiture, there are amazing black portraitists, you know, all of those things that, that, can, that should be brought to light.
Right. I think the other thing too is that, let me just jump real quick. That we can have these race conversations through art, you know, and we often do. Like, one of the people who I think is phenomenal at that is Kara Walker, all right? And her phenomenal silhouettes, and her even her exhibit last spring when she had that giant Sphinx made of sugar coat. Sugar-coated Sphinx.
Right in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, right in Brooklyn. Like, Marvelous Sugar Baby. Yeah. Like, and that, like, invoked, you know, some type of uncomfortability for a lot of, you know, white people and for some black people, you know, because it has these black caricatures, you know, the wide nose and the big lips, and, like, it had the scarf. Even it was posed in a real sexual type of way, you know, on all fours. And I think, too, like, she had a hidden camera. You guys heard about that?
No, I didn't know that.
No.
Yeah, she had a hidden camera there at the Brooklyn Museum because she wanted to see how people actually interacted with the Sphinx. And you see a lot of people taking kind of like crude selfies, you know, like putting their finger up by the, you know, vagina, or, you know.
Really?
Like trying to like taking pictures, kind of like pinching the nipples and all these other type of things. So it's really like revealing about how people are still kind of sexualizing the Sphinx, even though the whole thing was about the sexualization of black women. Like, they still found a way to sexualize it, even though it's supposed to be a conversation about how the black woman, the black body, is so sexualized.
Wow, wow. That's amazing. One of the interesting pieces that was in the tour today was by Henry Owasa Tanner, and it's it's the Annunciation. Yeah, Annunciation. You know, where Mary is visited by the angel Gabriel. And Henry had been trained classically in the Philadelphia area. He faced incredible ridicule and racism while he was at Philadelphia's foremost art academy at the time. In fact, at one point during his time there, he was strung up like Jesus and hung on a cross in the square of the school. But after he had gotten his degree, he went to Paris and was studying there. And to do this picture, he went and traveled on the dime of the Barnes family here in Philadelphia to the Middle East, because he wanted to get a real sense of the true surroundings that would have been there, what a Middle Eastern woman would have looked like. And so his portrait of the Annunciation, even in the late 1800s, he was already trying to reclaim the narrative as an artist of what Mary really looks like. She's not a lily white woman. She's a Middle Eastern woman with darker skin. She's in humble, more Moorish setting in the photograph. And so you're so right, Zali, when you say that we do get to reclaim this narrative through art. And we've been doing it for a really long time. Absolutely. The next thing I wanted to talk about was something interesting that I came across, which is Dr. Carolyn Finney wrote this book called Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. I hadn't ever thought about this before, but it was really interesting to look at, again, just one more area of the world that black people have been erased from, and what that means. I'm going to play just a little bit of a video of Dr. Finney speaking with Tavis Smiley.
A recent survey commissioned by the National Park Service showed that only 7% of visitors to the park system are African Americans. Latinos also underrepresented. Dr. Carolyn Finney, an assistant professor of environmental science, policy, and management at UC Berkeley, explores this disconnect in an important new book titled Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors, which combines environmental history with cultural and race studies to give us a critical insight into why this has occurred and what we can do about changing it. Dr. Finney, it's an honor to have you on this program.
And it's an honor to be here. Thank you so
much.
Let
me start by asking why these numbers for blacks and Latinos at the National Park Service, at least, are so abysmal.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we could talk about this from a whole lot of different angles, right? So the first thing I want to say is that numbers don't tell you everything, right? Numbers come are a very particular way of quantifying something. And so we don't see black and Latino people at the parks. That doesn't mean that black people don't have relationship with the environment.
Right.
I think there's a number of different reasons for this. I think part of it is historical. I talk about how we look at the issue of slavery and segregation and redlining and racial profiling and all the ways within which black people have been kind of marginalized in the larger story about who this country is and who gets to participate in building that story. The parks are part of that story. Right, the parks are actually central to that narrative, right, in terms of creating these natural spaces that we could show to the rest of the world to say, this is who we are as Americans. But black people didn't actually get to participate, have access to be part of that creation of those parks back in the beginning. So part of it for me is history around that. Part of it has to do with who we see in the media. You know, what images are we seeing? When we see anything having to do with the parks or more broadly the environment, who do we see? Who don't we see? And when we do see black or brown people doing something, what are they doing in relationship to the environment? When I think about issues of leadership, who gets to make decisions about how these spaces should be used? Who gets to engage in the parks? Who do we see when we go to these spaces? Who are the rangers? Who are the people who are the superintendents? I think a lot about in the interpretation, the stories that we tell of these places. And this is changing and improving. Mm-hmm. So I want to be really careful not to diminish the work that some folks are doing out there to really expand the story of who we are. But I also want to say, based on so many people I talk to around the country who have amazing stories, black people, about their relationship to the environment and their ideas and their creativity, we don't hear a lot about those stories. And so part of that gets translated into black people aren't engaged with the environment, black people don't care. And I actually want to cut that myth off there, because I said that's not true at all.
Let me throw a curveball at you.
Yeah, please.
So I was fascinated just listening to both this interview and just reading some more. I actually bought the book. I'm going to start it on a trip that I'm taking tomorrow, so hopefully I'll have some more tidbits from it. But one thing that I read and didn't know was that Charles Young, a black army captain born into slavery in Maeslake, Kentucky, with his segregated company that he had, and Chris Cott saws, transformed the Sequoia forest into the impenetrable wilderness into a tourist mecca. In 1903, with a team of mules hitched to wagons, Young's mountaineers became the first to enter the giant forest on four wheels. So it was a black person that actually created the Sequoia National Forest, the national park there.
Mm, mm.
When you talk about erasure, I don't know how much more of erasure could be than that fact that a black person spearheaded and designed this park that I could tell you right now that I'm sure if you ask any white person, they would say, oh, this was, you know, a white man put this all together for sure. So it's very interesting.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, when you think about the talents that black people have, you know, it doesn't extend to one specific area. We're not a monolith. We are people still. We're just people who are marginalized because of skin color, but we all have different interests. Mm-hmm. And so to the degree that that happens and the degree that we're allowed to succeed in those interests happens, it's, you know, you get to see it, and it's a problem that we don't show it more often. It really is.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is too is the when we talk about blackness, and like you said, we're now like a monolith, that people really have to realize the diversity of blackness and the vibrancy of blackness, the creativity of blackness, and that we always get trapped in this singular idea of an authentic blackness. You know, there's only one right or way to be black, you know, and it's not. There's no right way to be black or no wrong way to be black. You know, you living your human life is an authentic black experience. And mm-hmm. when people don't fall into that stereotype, they kind of get erased, right? That you only get that media on TV if you fall within this type of, you know, narrow definition of what blackness is. You know, you don't see a lot of like you say, environmentalists on there, black environmentalists. And even when you look at the History Channel, right, and they're in Egypt, like you're in Egypt and this white person covering Egypt, this white archaeologist, like you could not find no black archaeologist to talk about Egypt. And it's things like that that kind of like rub me the wrong way.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's so deliberate, too.
Right.
Going back to the Sequoia National Park, I mean, they have a summit trail that has the name of John Muir. They have trees that are named recognizing presidents and heroes of war and all sorts of stuff, but no mention of the man who actually did this hard work of building this space. Dr. Finney actually tells a story on why she actually got interest in this, and independent of her own self, but she grew up just outside of New York City. Her father, when he came back from the Korean War, they moved north from the south. They grew up poor down there. Her parents did, and they had her dad had two opportunities. One was to be a janitor in Syracuse, or to be a caretaker living on a wealthy estate just outside the city. And so they took the opportunity to go to the wealthy estate and take care of it. It was 12 acres with a pond and fish and vegetable gardens and all sorts of stuff. So, you know, animals, deer, geese, etc. And she spent a lot of time in the outdoors, and her parents took care of all of this land. She says the first conservationist she ever knew were her parents. Her parents, obviously, they got older and they left the space and couldn't do that job anymore. They moved to Virginia after retirement. But the neighbors from the area would send letters whenever something significant happened. In 2005 or 6, her father got a letter saying that there had been a conservation easement placed on the property, which meant forever, nothing could be changed, no new buildings added. So it was really a great thing for the space to be saved. They were thanking in these letters the new owner for his conservation mindness. And she said, and when she was reading these letters, she was like, why don't y'all thank my parents? Because, you know, they took care of the land for 50 years.
Mm.
You want to mention them in your erasure?
Yeah.
Just because this dude had some money to throw up? That's it? That's all you want to talk about? And it's moments like...
There had to be something to preserve.
Yeah. I mean, there wouldn't be anything there except for their effort. Except for them being conservationists and working and making sure that everything was taken care of there and respecting mm-hmm. the land. And so it's such a false, you know, it's such an erasure of the efforts that they did and the work that they did and hard work that they did over such a long amount of time loving this space. And it's it's what's kind of set her on this path to do some more research about this, because she thought if her parents were so easily erased in their efforts of conservation, she could only imagine there were many other Black stories just like that across the country. And so she kind of set out to tell some of those stories. I'll put a link to the book and everything on the show notes, but I thought it was a really unique perspective and something. Again, I always am for lifting up, as we always say, we're not a monolith, and this is a great way of illustrating that. Kind of not necessarily even bucking the stereotypes, but just showing that there should be no stereotypes, because that's just ridiculous. There's no such thing as a stereotypical Black person.
Well, yes, there is, and it's a straw man, but for some reason it exists, and we even accept it very much. You think about like the dominant white culture and how they set up the stereotypes of Black people, and how we basically have grown to accept and relish in them in some respects. And you know, the first thing I can immediately think of is somebody asking me, like, when I was a kid, you want to go to Big Bear and go snowboarding? What? Niggas don't snowboard. Fuck out of here. What I look like?
Mm-hmm.
And I limited, like, I stopped myself from having. Or experiencing something that I may have liked. I know now that I wouldn't have fucking liked that shit. But
that's
it's just
not
a matter
you're,
of.
That, but that's not because you're Black, though.
Yeah,
I think
and it's not because
thing.
I'm Black. It's
just not because
I don't like the snow.
Yeah, like, you don't like the snow. So
you know what
that's
I mean?
Okay.
Like it's something that we accept it so much, and it's so much a part of our culture. That's why when people sit up there and say, oh, well, you know, I don't have a problem with Black people. I have a problem with the culture. Oh, well, who sets the expectations of the culture? Because we don't control any media companies. Well, I'm sorry. Oprah controls a media company. She doesn't have nearly the reach that the remaining TV companies have. Mm-hmm. So who's painting those? Who's painting or creating that culture?
Yeah, that was my favorite part of that whole argument that they were having on Morning Joe, you know, and the rappers F this and N-word this and kill this. This is what white people are listening to. It's like,
that's what they want.
Whose fault is that? I think you need to be looking at the white people here. Because if it was just a matter of only stuff that Black people like being popular, I'm pretty sure we wouldn't be getting killed on the streets every day. Just a guess. Just saying. If it was just a matter of us thinking, let's have this be popular now. Poof.
And you know what's even crazier? If white people actually wanted respectable Black people, they wouldn't amplify that shit. So it goes to show right off the bat, they don't fucking care. It's about painting a negative picture of people as a way of demonizing them and scaring the shit out of people. So that, oh, well, it's okay to take advantage of this subsection of the population, and let's just experiment and see what we can get away with them, and then we can move on to the remainder of the population. That's what they do. We're always the fucking canary in the minefield. When you look at the subprime loan crisis, when you look at just fuck anything bad, it usually happens to us twice over.
And first and last.
Yeah.
Right?
The
right.
truth. It's the truth. And you know, you can go back to Tuskegee experiments, to Vietnam, to so very much, even if you go back as early as the Civil War, quite frankly.
The unemployment rate, twice
it's,
as bad.
It's true.
The national average.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about Blackout Day, Zelly, because I know you were prolifically tweeting during Blackout Day and Blackout Weekend, and I know we've got the next one coming up April 3rd. I'm pretty excited about that.
Excited.
It's going to be awesome. So tell me what got you so jazzed about it, and kind of what your thoughts were on how it went and how it was received, and just generally what you thought.
I thought it was an amazing idea. I didn't even notice it at first until someone on Tumblr sent me a message asking me, was I participating in it? And then that's when I looked into it further, and I was like, yes, I have to get involved in this, because this is coming off the heels of we have Black Appreciation Day, or Black Women Appreciation
Day.
We also had, what was it, Black Love?
Yep.
And then I know Darnell Moore, he had his own hashtag that kind of amplified queer relationships.
Yes. I do remember that.
So we had all these hashtags that was kind of like amplifying, you know, the diversity of Blackness and celebrating blackness in general, and for this to be on Tumblr and Twitter and all social media, and it was really organized and everyone was real conscious about it, I thought it was a phenomenal idea. And that day and that whole weekend was very, very beautiful. One of the things that I was trying to do was trying to mix it up to keep it going. So I was telling people, you know, twit pick yourself, you know, with your natural hair, twit pick yourself in your when you graduated, or twit pick yourself doing something that is outside the notions of blackness, right? And that was my favorite twit pick challenge, because you had people, you know, twit picking themselves snowboarding or hiking or skydiving or things that people don't usually associate with, you know, that stereotypical blackness.
Mm-hmm. But Zelly, niggas don't snowboard.
All right? Niggas don't snowboard. And people was actually posting, like, video clips. And, you know, they don't snowboard. They got, like, 5 feet, you know, but before they fell down. But, you know, at least they attempted it.
Like most people do when they try to snowboard. Most people find out that snowboarding isn't for them real
it's quick.
17 feet of taking off.
It's true. It's not like all white people snowboard either. That's what I always like to think. Oh. It's like, yeah, I know mostly the... of the people snowboarding, it's almost all white people, but that doesn't mean all white people would like it either.
Right. You know? Yeah. So it was an amazing day, you know, that we had the chance to uplift people. And especially on Tumblr, it was phenomenal, because you had the marginalized being really uplifted that day. You know, so people was making a real conscious effort to reblog our darker brothers and sisters, to reblog our trans brothers and sisters, our disabled brothers and sisters, and it was amazing, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. It was fantastic. Definitely I'm so amazing. Excited. It's going to be the first Friday of every month, so the next one that's coming up is April 3rd, so be on the lookout for that. I will heartily participate, as I did this last one. It was really fun.
Oh, yes, you did.
I missed it.
No, she had a pick for, like, every challenge.
Man, I got picks for days. Damn. You know what it is? I'm the baby of my family, so I was very well documented, generally speaking, and I've kept that going. Certainly, it's funny. I always think about, I don't know how old you guys both are, but I think about my nieces and nephews who are, you know, teenagers and younger. It's like they have never known a time where they weren't capturing their own lives in such a huge way. We didn't have that. It was always somebody else was, you know, the keeper of the memories in that way. And it's a very interesting thing for young people now to have that opportunity to look back, not on what somebody else wanted to say about you at 13, but what you wanted to look like, how you wanted to take a picture, how you wanted to record yourself. It's pretty cool. I think it's going to make for some interesting
awesome.
Grandchild moments in the future, but still, it's pretty cool.
I'm going to have to hop on some Twitter some April 3rd.
Oh, Lord. Yeah.
I mean, I'm never on Twitter.
It's on Tumblr, too. It was really great on Tumblr.
All I have is the Riot and White People Tumblr, so I don't really be on there either unless I see some white people rioting.
Well, you do. St. Patrick's Day. They was out there.
I got posts. I know. Riot and White People. Tumblr.com, people.
That's right. And in fact, the original plan was for it to just be on Tumblr, but the interest was so huge that it quickly was like, nah, let's black everything out. All black everything. So
yeah, and like it initially was about, you know, just post a selfie, and then it became, you know, post a story about yourself, you know, like a narrative about the picture, the purpose of the picture, and then, you know, I was starting to hit them up with the themes, you know, and the challenges. So it just kept on going. Like, people was like, we love it.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. And let me see if... Oops. I think it was... Was it... I thought I saw somebody had tweeted me earlier. I think there's a theme for the April one, too. I don't remember what it was. But anyways, again, that's going to be April 3rd, so be on the lookout for that. The other thing that I wanted to mention was Blackout Tour, which was in New York... last month sometime. They did the first Blackout Tour, and you can go to blackouttour.tumblr.com to see the details on that. I don't know, did you see that, Zelly, that action at all?
Yeah, I did see it. I wasn't able to participate in it, but I have been keeping an eye on it.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. And what it was we talked about a little bit on the program, and I did an interview with Ricky on his show about it as well, which is it's really about reclaiming the space of monuments to white supremacy. So in New York, they targeted the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, and they did scouting trips and kind of decided on specific stops that really were telling a false narrative that was steeped in white supremacy. And they created an alternate tour of the space. And so at each of the stops, they pointed out what was problematic about the space, what it could or should be saying, and kind of making a space for people to start talking about what it means in terms of Black Lives Matter and reclaiming these narratives from these, again, like I said, monuments to white supremacy. So we are encouraging people in your cities to go out to some of these monuments to white supremacy and do these scouting trips and do the work. I'm doing it here with a group in Philadelphia. We're going to be putting together a blackout tour of Old City, Philadelphia, which has a lot of very informative spots that are telling some false narratives in a big way. And as I was saying also on the interview, is that I'm already finding so much joy in the actual work of putting it together. I know it'll be great to do the tour and to have people experience it, but working with the other people that I'm working with, talking about these things, doing the research, just the community that you build in learning this stuff together is incredibly empowering. So I just encourage everyone to do that. And wouldn't it be cool when you can go to blackouttour.tumblr.com and go to almost any major museum and institution and take the blackout tour instead? That'd be cool.
But Leslie, niggas don't go to museums.
Now we just them. We just build them, that's all.
Yeah, we just build them.
Yep. That's it, that's all we do. The last thing I wanted to mention, I had sent you guys this link to these Black Surfers and Reclaiming Cultural History in Los Angeles article, which I thought was a really interesting article about the history of Black people surfing. Did you guys get a chance to take a look at that?
That's the one I didn't get a chance to take a look at.
It's pretty cool. Again, this is mostly Los Angeles based people, but they were pushed off of beaches through segregation, even in the early 1900s, and they didn't give a crap. They were out setting off for the beach, especially in the early decades of the 20th century. And in Los Angeles, there was a little bit more flexibility given to them, and so they were able to get out and surf and enjoyed it and were really quite good at it. And so there's this movement to kind of reclaim this heritage and stop this whitewash narrative that it's not something we have enjoyed, would enjoy today and could continue to enjoy. I have such a I don't even know. I've been forming these thoughts about some of these stereotypes, you know, this one about Black people in swimming and how its roots can be traced, or probably can be traced in my mind, I think, to, not wanting slaves to escape by waterways. And how it's almost as though a pain that's continually revisited on us, as Ricky says, if we box ourselves into these cages that have been created for us by white supremacy. And so a part of the Black Lives Matter movement for me is in reclaiming these cultural historical things and in reclaiming the narrative about Blackness and what it means and all the richness that it entails is freeing ourselves from those invisible chains that have lingered on us for so, so long. So do you know any Black surfers, Ricky?
No, I don't know any personally, but this is the thing. I have to remember this now. We're fucking equal. We're born, we're treated differently, but we're actually equal. And so, to the degree that there are Black surfers, is to the degree that white people allow it. It's not that white. It's not that Black people can't surf. It's plenty of kids in the hood in Long Beach, or like the north side of Long Beach or the east side of Long Beach, who can skateboard their asses off. Right. They don't have money to go to a beach. That shit costs money. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, a lot of times they're just kind of left out of it more than anything else.
Mm. Yeah. And I think a lot of times when we talk about, you know, we want freedom, like this is an aspect of freedom, right? That mm-hmm. we get to live our lives freely and a full human experience so that we're not caged by these societal standards or, you know, oh, only black people do this. Only black people can do that. Only white people can do this. You know, like when we want freedom, it's just not like economic freedom.
Yep.
You know, we want like full freedom to do, enjoy our lives as we should be, you know? So we're no longer constrained, like you said, in those invisible chains. Like we can be able to freely surfboard if we want to surfboard, you know, and do all these other type of things, you know, without having that fear that, oh, someone's going to police me for liking anime or liking punk music or something like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, even for me, like growing up, going to school in Compton, like to have an interest in news and history and politics was like weird. I don't even get it sometimes. But, you know, it's, again, what does economic equality help that? It most certainly does because right. it opens more doors. But it's not the only thing. There has to be a cultural change within the American society, not just black culture, because it doesn't translate into black culture. It doesn't originate within black culture. It originates within white culture. It then bleeds over into black culture because black culture is, by definition in this country, a subculture.
Mm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
That blackness that people want to point to is a subculture, and it's a subculture that's forced to be one because of how they're treated, not because they want to be that way. The reason why you have black kids click together at a school where there aren't very many black kids is because if they don't, they feel like they're going to be fucking picked on. And I've been there. I went to a private school my 9th and 10th grade year, and I didn't really want to be there. I didn't have very many friends there. And from like my 9th grade year, I hung out with a couple of kids that I went to junior high with. Didn't really care for them then in junior high, but, you know, they were people I knew versus the black people I didn't know and didn't really feel like getting to know other than, you know, I just wanted to do Ricky shit. And it didn't seem like some of them had the same interest. It was what it was. By 10th grade, I was done with that shit. I had to hang around the black people because there was that feeling of being picked on and being fucked with. And no one being there to defend you. If I'm not being picked on or fucked with, why do I need to defend myself?
Right.
Why do I need to hang out with just black people? So to the degree that you have that is the degree that these children or this group of people feels like they have to do so for their own survival, their own peace of mind.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's going to bring us to the end of the show. But Zelly, tell us where people can find you. Wherever they can find you, please let everyone know.
Oh, definitely. You guys can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Zelly Imani. That's ZELLIEIMANI, no spaces. And my website is black-culture.com.
Awesome. And do you guys have anything, any stories coming out soon or any projects you guys are working on in black culture?
Definitely. We're actually going to have an interview with Hank W. Thomas, the artist, the conceptual artist. We posted up this weekend.
Cool. Awesome. I'll look forward to seeing that for sure. Mm-hmm. Ricky, I know you can find Ricky occasionally on Twitter and certainly on April 3rd at AUADOT.org and on Facebook at facebook.com/AUA Movement and on their website, AUAMovement.org. And you can also download the new AUA Movement app for Android right now, right?
Yep. It should be available on the Google Play Store within the next couple of weeks, too. So I hadn't planned on putting it on there until the beginning of next month, but it should be there earlier.
Awesome sauce. You can find me on Twitter at Leslie Mack. That's M-A-C. And you can find this podcast, as always, on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search Ferguson Response. You can find tools and resources for the Black Lives Matter movement at FergusonResponse.org. And you can find your city or add your city in terms of actions that are going on FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. Thanks again for joining us, and we will see you next time.